Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, July 6, 2022. President Joe Biden traveling to Cleveland, announcing a plan to help underfunded multi-employer pension plans, expected to prevent pension cuts for up to 3 million union retirees. Also criticizing Republicans for not voting for the money when it was part of the $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package last year. President Biden also commenting about the police shooting death of Jaylen Walker in Akron, Ohio, as videos showing Walker shot by 8 officers up to 60 times while unarmed after he fled during a traffic stop. President Biden promising the Justice Department will take appropriate action if the investigation reveals federal criminal violations by the police. The suspect in the Highland Park, Illinois mass shooting on the 4th of July appears in court for the first time and reportedly confesses to the crime and is ordered held without bond. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson facing enormous pressure from his own Conservative Party to resign after the latest scandal. Johnson accused of promoting a member of parliament to a leadership position 2 years after being warned of a harassment complaint against him, and now that member resigning, accused of groping 2 men. We'll hear from the Prime Minister and talk about this with C-SPAN's Westminster producer, Peter Knowles. Also, the latest from the White House efforts to free WNBA star Brittany Griner from a Russian jail. And Supreme Court reporters and a law professor look ahead to the next term of the court, starts in October, when the new justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson, will consider her first cases. From the Wall Street Journal, the Biden administration is expanding how pension funds can invest federal aid, one of the finishing touches on a roughly $90 billion pension bailout approved last year for millions of painters, truck drivers, and other workers facing deep cuts to their retirement benefits. More than $6 billion has already been awarded to 27 plans, according to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, the government's pension insurer. Some workers whose pension benefits were cut by more than half have been restored, the agency said. The aid will keep shaky so-called multi-employer pension plans solvent through 2051, according to the White House. President today traveling to a high school in Cleveland, the crowd dominated by union members, talking about this and also taking aim at Republicans who did not support the American Rescue Plan, the name for last year's $1.9 trillion coronavirus relief package.
I'd love to tell you everyone that here that this policy that honors hard work and ensures dignified retirement was universally supported regardless of political party. But this is an important point, and it really matters. Unfortunately, that's not the case. Not one single Republican, this is what I'm talking about. Not one single solitary Republican voted for the Butch-Lewis Act or this legislation. And folks, I can tell you, those of us I was in the Congress a long time, and the people are still in the Congress. There's ones who wanted to, but they're afraid to. Afraid to, because the Trumpers would literally take them out. Not a joke. That's how bad it's gotten. We've got to change it. In fact, when this bill was moving through Congress, Republicans called these pensions, quote, rat holes. That was their phrase on the floor, Reverend. Rat holes. Who do they think they are? Who do they think you are, for God's sake? And my predecessor had a chance to act, but he didn't have a commitment to you or the courage to stand up to his own party to get things done, dismissing and ignoring the forgotten people he promised to help. Remember how he's going to help working class folks?
President Biden in Cleveland today. Associated Press writing, hurt politically by inflation at a 40-year high and damages wrought by the pandemic, the president is anchoring his message to workers in the former election bellwether of Ohio. The Buckeye State has been trending strongly Republican, with Donald Trump easily carrying it twice. And this is Biden's fourth visit as president as he labors to personally reverse that electoral tide. That was from the Associated Press. Today, though, two prominent Ohio Democrats were not with the president. The nominee for U.S. Senate, Tim Ryan, currently a congressman, and gubernatorial nominee, Nan Whalen, mayor. Both candidates campaigned citing unavoidable scheduling conflicts. Ohio Republican Senate nominee J.D. Vance releasing a statement that says Ryan has worked in lockstep with Biden to destroy our economy, and Ohio's middle class is suffering today because of it. But now, for the second time in 2 months, Ryan is refusing to be seen in public with his own party's president. More on unions and elections from a conservative perspective. Timothy Carney is a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Today he was interviewed by Michelle Nellenbach, vice president of the Bipartisan Policy Center.
In your book, you talk about unions. And this kind of surprised me, but you have a vision for how they could be reformed that would actually get, they're traditionally Democrat. Although, as we've seen lately, you certainly have a populist side of the Republican Party where some union members are actually supporting Republicans. And so there's a window there. Talk about kind of your new view of how this would work.
Now, it's funny because a huge part of what a lot of the pro-business side of the Republican Party has been doing for decades has been opposing unionization. And so a huge part of the Democratic political and donor base has been the labor unions. But I think that alignment isn't necessary, and it has to do with the laws about U.S. unionization, where it's not really voluntary on every level. A majority of workers at a certain shop or whatever vote to unionize, and boom, the employer has to represent the union, and workers either have to pay into the dues or there's a right to work law, and it's just a legislative battle. The Ghent system, after Northern Europe, that I learned about while writing Alienated America, is the unions are more voluntary. They're the ones that sell and provide unemployment insurance. So if you're a worker, you're going to join a union because that's how you get unemployment insurance. And then what they do is they use their bargaining power. They say, look, if you want to hire any of us, you have to give us these conditions. So they do the collective bargaining that way to get better pay, to get better benefits, that sort of thing. But they also act as real community institutions, what we were talking about earlier, something like a bowling league or a church parish. For the working class in America, that's in the middle class, that's long been sort of where they meet people, where you might meet your spouse, where you have a mentor, where you have, a mentee, where you find your volunteering hours, your sense of purpose. All of that stuff can be in a union. But if it's something that you didn't exactly sign up for, you got the job and you're told you had to join the union, you're going to have less buy-in to it. The more that you said, no, I signed up for this, I'm on board with this union, you can do it. So this is better for employers because they can decide whether or not to do business with the unions. Conservatives should like the idea of moving unemployment insurance further away from the government. Democrats should like the idea of something that's going to swell the ranks of union members. And also, conservatives, again, a lot of guys, Blake Masters running for Senate in Arizona, he said, we need to have a country where it's easier to raise a family on a single income. What made that more possible in the 1950s and 60s was good union jobs. And that's not just a saying. Like, this is where a guy with a high school degree could earn a living if he was just willing to show up every day for 30 years. So stronger unions are going to help us get that more stable family economic life. But the way they're currently drafted, they're sort of inherently antagonistic and inherently political. The Ghent system in Northern Europe, I think, possibly could change that.
Timothy Carney is a senior fellow with AEI, American Enterprise Institute, which hosted today's program. Full title of that book that they referenced, Alienated America, Why Some Places Thrive While Others Collapse. Wall Street today, the Dow up 69, NASDAQ up 39, S&P up 13. The Congressional Black Caucus, writes The Hill newspaper, on Wednesday called for more action on police reform following the death of Jaylen Walker, a black man who was shot and killed by police in Akron, Ohio. The Akron Police Department on Saturday released body cam footage of police firing a barrage of bullets at Walker as they pursued him over an unspecified traffic violation late last month. Congresswoman Joyce Beatty, Democrat from Ohio, chair of the CBC, saying in a statement, from every account, he was a family man loved by many. He should still be alive today. The body camera footage is gut-wrenching and leaves us with far more questions than answers. Back to President Biden in Cleveland, about 25 miles from Akron, President talking about the Jaylen Walker shooting.
I want to make one serious comment about the shooting and the death of Jaylen Walker. The Justice Department and Civil Rights Division of the FBI field office in Akron, Ohio, and the local U.S. Attorney's Office are closely monitoring and reviewing what happened. And the FBI continues to coordinate with state and local partners to provide resources and specialized skill. If the evidence reveals potential violations of federal criminal statutes, The Justice Department will take the appropriate action. And I just want you to know what's going to happen.
President Biden in Cleveland, the mayor of Akron, Ohio, lifting the curfew the city has imposed during the ongoing demonstrations in response to the police shooting of Jaylen Walker. Daniel Hargan saying in a statement today, the curfew was put in place due to safety concerns for our downtown corridor and our residents. What I want our residents and community to know is that we are not arresting protesters who choose to peacefully protest. The accused gunman in the deadly Independence Day mass shooting in Highland Park, Illinois, Robert Cremo III, had his first court appearance today, charged with 7 counts of first-degree murder after outside the Lake County Criminal Court Tower in Waukegan, Illinois, State's Attorney Eric Reinhart speaking to reporters.
This morning, a few moments ago, the judge ruled that Robert Cremo III would be held without bond and that there was probable cause to hold him at this time for 7 counts of first-degree murder. We have filed those counts alleging the intentional killing of 7 individuals. Based on the information that the investigation has produced so far, the judge found that the evidence was at such a level that he could be held without bond. Also, because the fact that it is a mandatory life sentence. Additional details were developed during that bond hearing. I know there was a pool reporter there for that. I can certainly answer some additional questions about that. I want to continue to emphasize that this is an ongoing and active investigation with all of our law enforcement partners. If anyone has any surveillance footage whatsoever of the July 4th Highland Park parade, we would urge them to contact the Highland Park Police Department. Deputy Chief Covelli probably has the best phone number for that. I can take a few questions.
Sure. Can you tell us, there's been this question about how the shooter obtained these weapons, this question about maybe the father sponsoring this license even after there was initial contact with law enforcement. Are you looking at any potential criminal charges with other family members, the parents, perhaps?
I don't want to comment on that. I don't want to answer that question right now in terms of what our work continues to be to look at all of the information and evidence in this case.
Is there precedent to charge a family member who has signed off on a FOID application to someone who's under 21?
That is not something that I have done in my administration. It is something we can get back to you on that question in terms of whether that's been done in the past. I know there's another state in Michigan, totally different set of facts. We can get back to you on that, but that's not something that I have personally done while I've been state attorney.
The last hearing, Mr. Cremo's statement to police was discussed. Can you please elaborate on that and what the
Well, his statement was voluntary. He was questioned in the Highland Park Police Department. He was read his Miranda warnings, offered attorneys, etc. He went into details about what he had done. He admitted to what he had done.
Can you provide
Oh, and I was also asked the question if he said why he did it. We don't want to speculate on motives right now.
Eric Reinhart, Lake County, Illinois state's attorney, speaking to reporters after today's court appearance by that suspect in the Independence Day parade shooting in Highland Park, Illinois. Questions about the family of the suspect. Washington Post reporting, the Illinois State Police confirmed on Tuesday that the father of the Highland Park parade shooting suspect sponsored his son's application for a gun permit months after relatives reported that Robert E. Cremo III had threatened to kill everyone and the authorities had insufficient basis to deny the application. The Lake County Major Crimes Task Force spokesman Christopher Covelli saying today that after the shooting on July 4th, Cremo fled to the Madison, Wisconsin area where he considered doing another mass shooting at an event there, decided against it, and then went back to Illinois where he was arrested. In Washington, D.C., U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland, ahead of a briefing on an unrelated anti-crime matter, speaking about the Highland Park shooting.
Before I begin, I just think we need to reflect on the horrific events in Highland Park, Illinois. This location is just 20 minutes from the house I grew up in, and I know it extremely well. It's just another horrific reminder of the violence and particularly the gun violence that we face and that we must do everything in our power to end. We don't need any more reminders of this.
Attorney General Merrick Garland in Washington. It was the start of a briefing on an anti-crime effort by the U.S. Marshals named Operation North Star, Garland announcing 1,500 dangerous criminals arrested in major cities across the country. This is Washington Today. White House says that President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris have spoken with Sherelle Griner, the wife of WNBA star Brittany Griner. This comes 2 days after Brittany Griner wrote a letter to the president from Russian jail, where she's on trial for drug smuggling, asking for help to be released. And the White House saying the president, vice president, reassuring Sherelle that the U.S. is working to secure Brittany's release as soon as possible. Brittany Griner was arrested back in February, allegedly with vape cartridges containing hashish oil. Here's the latest from the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre speaking with reporters aboard Air Force One.
Can you preview a little bit of what's in the president's letter to Brittany Griner? And does the public support coming out right now help or hurt the ability of the U.S. government to get her out of Russia?
Let me just start with the first part of your question, which is, and lay this down a little bit about what happened today. So President Biden spoke with Brittany's wife, Sherelle, today to make sure she knows we are doing everything we can to get Brittany home as quickly as possible. President Biden shared the letter with her that he is sending back to Brittany after receiving her deeply personal letter on July 4th, which all of you read. The president has been clear about the need to see every American who is wrongfully detained or held hostage abroad released, including Brittany Griner. Months ago, he directed his national security team to pursue every avenue to bring her home safely, to her family, friends, and loved ones. This has been top of mind for the president. He receives daily updates about the status of her negotiations to secure Brittany's release, and the U.S. government continues to work aggressively using every available means to bring her home along with other wrongfully detained Americans like Paul Whelan. And so this is, again, a top priority for this president. And like I just read, he gets daily updates on what is happening, how we're going to secure her efforts to come home, and also Paul Whelan.
There's been some reports in Russian media about a trade maybe for Victor Boot and Brittany Griner. Is that something the U.S. government would consider?
I'm not going to negotiate in public on this. This is something clearly that the State Department with the special envoy, they are focused on getting home not just Brittany Griner and Paul Whelan, but all U.S. nationals who are wrongfully detained abroad or held hostage abroad. Home. This is a priority for this president. I'm not gonna negotiate in public on this.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre speaking with reporters flying with the president on Air Force One from Washington to Ohio today. Over 1,000 black women have signed a letter to the president demanding that he and other members of the administration increase their efforts to get Brittany Griner released. The signers include Bernice King, the CEO of the King Center and daughter of the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Also Terry Jackson, executive director of the Women's National Basketball Players Association, and Donna Brazil, former acting chair of the Democratic National Committee. The letter says that Griner is enduring inhumane conditions during her imprisonment, and it is imperative that you, President Biden, address this ongoing human rights crisis and make a deal to bring Brittany home quickly and safely. Of course, this all comes amid the backdrop of Russia's ongoing war against Ukraine. This week, the Russian Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu saying that the war will end once President Vladimir Putin's tasks there are completed. And the defense minister, again, referring to what's happening as a special military operation, President Putin refusing to call it an actual war. It has been almost a week since the 2021-22 U.S. Supreme Court term ended. C-SPAN has been covering several panels of law professors and reporters reviewing the significant cases that have been decided. Today, a panel at the Heritage Foundation did that, but also looked to the next term, which starts in October. And what is in store for the Supreme Court with the newly sworn-in Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson? You're going to hear from Kevin Daly, Supreme Court reporter for the Washington Free Beacon, also Jess Braven, reports for the Wall Street Journal, Joe Alcia, is a Catholic University law professor, and Sarah Harris is an appellate attorney.
Justice Breyer has retired. Justice Jackson has been sworn in. What do you make of that? What changes do you see coming down the pipeline for the two reporters at the end? Will that affect how you cover the court in any way?
Well, I guess I'd say this. First, the justices have said in different venues that the arrival of a new member kind of puts them all on their best behavior. So to the extent things are pretty tense up there right now, Justice Jackson's arrival is timely. I remember, for example, when Justice Kavanaugh was confirmed, arguments in the courtroom on his first day on the bench were very playful. And the court that day was hearing an Armed Career Criminal Act case, so the substance was not the cause of everyone's good mood. I can remember, for example, Justice Sotomayor asking a hypothetical that involved a pinch, and she actually turned and pinched Justice Gorsuch, who made a playful face. And afterwards, Justice Kagan made a point of turning to shake Justice Kavanaugh's hand in full view of the court and the press. So it seems to me that to the extent things are bad up there right now, that, maybe Justice Jackson's arrival will kind of help everybody clear the slate for next term.
Well, I agree. Obviously, that's it's a small group, and even after the very contentious Kavanaugh hearings, Justice Sotomayor extremely complimentary towards him. I mean, even if they might be anticipated to disagree on a lot of cases, they all have to work with each other, and that I think is paramount. They all have an interest in maintaining their collegiality, if only to make it less unpleasant to go to the office. I think, for us, one thing, we're I think probably the same, Kevin, waiting to hear Justice Jackson's voice as a justice of the Supreme Court. She had a few opinions that were noted as a lower court judge, but she's mainly been a district judge and hasn't had the chance to really expound the way she thinks about these questions. And we haven't had a chance to really see her in oral argument and what she brings to the table, probably something different than Justice Breyer did. That would probably be true of like every other person on the planet. So I think, in terms of a subject, it is actually in some ways a sort of a relief to have something to write about that's not these, heavy topics and very weighty disputes that we've seen at the court this year. So, I think part of it will be what does she bring in terms of, personality and outlook and style. In terms of substance, I don't think we're expecting to be surprised. I mean, I guess the definition of surprise is you don't expect it. But still, she should fit in pretty comfortably in the three justice liberal minority on that court. Maybe there will be some areas I think we'll be looking for to see where she might, see things a little differently than the other two Democratic-appointed justices.
Yeah, and I think, to what Jess said, she will have ample opportunity to make her voice heard if she so wishes next term. She's recused from Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard, but the court granted review to a companion case in which UNC is the defendant, so she'll be able to participate there, the question being whether or not the court will overturn its affirmative action precedents. There are other cases involving the constitutionality of the Indian Child Welfare Act. There's a case involving a Christian website designer from Colorado who refused to create wedding websites for same-sex couples. Important voting rights cases that are on the court's docket for next term. So I think it usually takes a few terms to get a sense of who a justice is exactly and for their profile to kind of fill out. But I think that that process could be accelerated in Justice Jackson's case, given what's on the docket.
Kevin Daly, Washington Free Beacon.
I think that one of the more notable shifts here is in administrative law, in that I think for the reasons we just discussed, administrative law is likely to be a major frontier that the court will be confronting in the years to come, non-delegation doctrine, removal of executive officers, all sorts of doctrines that are going to be coming up.
Law professor Joe Alessia.
Justice Breyer was one of the staunchest defenders of the administrative state on the court, an admin scholar before he became a judge, and somebody who had a deep knowledge of administrative law and strong views about administrative law. And without him on the court for those cases, you still have Justice Kagan, who also is a staunch defender of the administrative state and a very articulate defender of the administrative state. But I do think that that might change the way that perhaps the dissents in those cases might end up approaching the argument. Justice Breyer would have been an important voice for the pro-administrative state position when those cases come up. And we don't know yet whether Justice Jackson will have the same views on those issues and will articulate them in a similar way. Probably not in a similar way, at least, as Justice Breyer would have.
Sarah?
I think on most cases, the judgment line will stay the same. I think the main exception I would say is actually Justice Breyer in lower profile criminal cases would sometimes side with the conservatives. So in Fourth Amendment cases, like perhaps the little known Utah versus Streiff, that's what I'm thinking of. But by and large, I think in the hot button cases, judgment line stays the same. The biggest difference is actually behind the scenes. Justice Breyer is like one of the most collegial people I think anyone who has ever interacted with him has ever met. He is just sort of personally engaging and I think a real bridge builder. And so I think especially last term, you would see him getting assigned really big opinions like Google versus Oracle or BL, the school cheerleader case. And so, you know, those cases were not like ideologically divided or anything, but they were big cases in which he was very successful in keeping a strong majority together. And I think it takes time to become that person. And so I think only time will tell, you know, will one of the members of the liberal wing sort of take over that role or will it sort of be increasingly polarized?
Appellate attorney Sarah Harris on a panel with Catholic University law professor Joe Alessia and two reporters who cover the Supreme Court, Jess Braven from The Wall Street Journal, Kevin Daly from the Washington Free Beacon, moderator Giancarlo Campanero with the Heritage Foundation. You can find the full discussion with them. They talk about a number of the cases decided during the current term. It's at our website at cspan.org. And the Supreme Court's new term starts first Monday in October. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today, which you can get as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile video app and wherever you get your podcasts. A couple more headlines. Former White House counsel under President Trump, Pat Cipollone, agreeing to testify before the House Select Committee investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Multiple reports from various news outlets today saying it'll be behind closed doors in a transcribed interview and will happen this Friday. You might remember in the most recent January 6th committee hearing, former White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson said that Cipollone was concerned that if former President Trump's January 6th rally led a march to the U.S. Capitol to try to stop the certification of the presidential election, quote, we're going to get charged with every crime imaginable. And lawyers for Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, saying that he will challenge a subpoena from the Fulton County, Georgia investigators looking into former President Trump's interference in the 2020 election in the country. The lawyers calling the investigation all politics and a fishing expedition. This from CNN in London. Boris Johnson's scandal-ravaged premiership appeared on the brink of collapse Wednesday after numerous ministers and former allies pulled their support for the beleaguered British prime minister and urged him to resign before he's forced from office. Johnson began the day vowing to fight on despite the shock resignations of his finance minister, health secretary, and dozens of other lawmakers furious about the latest saga to engulf Downing Street. The handling of a resignation by Johnson's former deputy chief whip, Chris Pincher, who was accused of groping two men last week. Here is the prime minister. He leads the Conservative Party, questioned by the opposition, Labour Party leader Keir Starmer, during Prime Minister's question time in the House of Commons in London.
Mr. Speaker, last week, a government minister was accused of sexually assaulting a young man. I want to quote the victim's account. He says, he grabbed my ass and then he slowly moved his hand down in front of my groin. I froze. I accept that's not easy listening, but it's a reminder to all those propping up this Prime Minister just how serious the situation is. He knew the accused minister had previously committed predatory behaviour, but he promoted him to a position of power anyway. Why?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, that individual, the member for Tamworth, no longer has the Conservative whip. He no longer has a job. He is no longer, as soon as I was made aware of the allegation that he has just read out, Mr. Speaker, and the complaint that was made, he lost his status as a Conservative MP, and he is now the subject, Mr. Speaker, of an independent investigation to the Complaints and Grievances Panel. And that is entirely right. And I want to say to him, Mr. Speaker, I want to say to him that I abhor bullying and abuse of power anywhere in Parliament, in this party or in any other party.
Keir Starmer.
None of that explains why he promoted him in the first place. And we've heard it all before. We know who he really is. Before he was found out, he's reported to have said he's handsy. That's the problem. Pincher by name, pincher by nature. Now, has the Prime Minister ever said words to that effect? And I'm not asking for bluster and half-truth. We've all had enough of that. Yeah. Yes or no?
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I'm not going to trivialise what happened. Because there's very serious complaints have been raised against the member for Tamworth, and they're now being investigated, Mr. Speaker. It is true that a complaint was raised when he was in the Foreign Office and the matter was resolved. It's absolutely true. It's absolutely true, Mr. Speaker, that it was raised with me. I greatly regret that he continued in office, and I have said that before, Mr. Speaker, but it is now the subject of an independent investigation, and that is the right thing, Mr. Speaker. And frankly, I think the people of this country would like also to hear about other jobs that are held by people in this country, not least the 500,000 people we got off welfare into work in the last 6 months alone, Mr. Speaker. Those are things that are making differences to the lives of people up and down the country, and I'm proud of it.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson questioned by the Labour Party leader Keir Starmer during Prime Minister's question time in the House of Commons in London. PMQ, a regular feature of Wednesdays when Parliament is in session. After today's questions ended, one of the Conservative members who resigned his cabinet position, Sajid Javid, explaining to the members why he's stepping down as Secretary of State for Health and Social Care.
When the first stories of parties in Downing Street emerged late last year, I was personally assured at the most senior level by my Right Honourable Friend's then team that, and I quote, there had been no parties in Downing Street and no rules were broken. So I gave the benefit of doubt. And I went on those media rounds to say that I'd had those assurances from the senior, most senior level of the Prime Minister's team. Then we had more stories. We had the Sue Gray report, a new Downing Street team. I continued to give the benefit of the doubt. And now this week again, we have reason to question the truth and integrity of what we've all been told. And at some point, we have to conclude that enough is enough. I believe that point is now. I welcome the Prime Minister's public acknowledgement last night that matters could have been handled better in who he appointed and what was said about what he knew when. And I appreciated his kind and humble words and his humble spirit when I went to see him yesterday, and also the kind letter that he has sent to me. But I do fear that the reset button could only work so many times. There's only so many times you can turn that machine on and off before you realise that something is fundamentally wrong. Last month, I gave the benefit of doubt one last time. But I haven't concluded that the problem starts at the top. That is not going to change. I have concluded that the problem starts at the top, and I believe that is not going to change. And that's means that it is for those of us in a position who have responsibility to make that change. I wish my Cabinet colleagues well, and I can see they have decided to remain in the Cabinet. They will have their own reasons. But it is a choice. I know just how difficult that choice is. But let's be clear. Not doing something is an active decision. I am deeply concerned about how the next generation will see the Conservative Party on our current course. Our reputation, after 12 years in government, depends on regaining the public's trust. This is not just a personal matter. The philosophy and perception of Conservatives depends on it.
Sajid Javid. Joining us now with more on Prime Minister Boris Johnson's situation from London, C-SPAN's Westminster producer Peter Knowles. Thanks for being with us. Is the Prime Minister in trouble of losing his job?
Very much so. There's the evidence from the last 24 hours all points that way, starting with the resignation of two very senior ministers, which happened early evening yesterday. It has been the most tumultuous 24 hours through a succession of resignations of ministers and their assistants. A pretty grim Prime Minister's questions, and then a committee appearance, which was fairly breathtaking. So, yeah, it's been a very big 24 hours.
Well, in Prime Minister's questions, what type of questions did the Prime Minister face from the opposition and from his own members?
The opposition questions sort of fade from the memory, because what is quite spectacular is when you see a serving Prime Minister under attack from his own side, when Prime Ministers are absolutely used to most horrid things being said about them face to face, across the benches, across the floor of the House. But to be under such fierce criticism from behind is pretty difficult to live with. So there were three MPs on his own side who said, enough is enough, time for you to go, in the most direct terms you could imagine. What all the Prime Minister could do is engage in false politeness. I thank you very much for that point. And say, I disagree with you, and that it's important to keep on going, and there are big issues in the world, Ukraine and so forth. But that level of ferocity of attack, and what was really interesting is there was another event that followed on immediately after Prime Minister's questions, which was one of the resignation speeches, that the personal statement. And during that 10-minute speech, which I think has been seen now on C-SPAN and is available online, you got a lot of nodding and agreement, very openly breaking out amongst Sajid Javid's colleagues. And the Prime Minister just had to sit there and take it. And as he left the chamber, there were shouts, I think, from the opposition, bye-bye, Boris. And not a murmur of support from his own side. So pretty horrid start to the day.
And then you said the Prime Minister went to the liaison committee, a discussion of actual issues, Ukraine and Russia and the economy. But did the other problems sort of make their way into the questioning as well?
Yes. I mean, the way this works is the senior MPs, who are chairs of the select committees, very much modelled, actually, on congressional committees. I mean, they've taken their lead from Congress. They work out a line of questioning, and it's always pretty tough for the Prime Minister. It is not an easy session. Tony Blair was the only one who looked like he ever actually enjoyed it. And over a two-hour period, which is a fairly sustained period of questioning, they go and look at two or three topics. So Ukraine was first, cost of living crisis and inflation. But they moved on, and this was planned and pre-announced, to integrity in government. And the consensus that has emerged among so many MPs of Boris Johnson's own party, the Conservative Party, as well as the opposition, that this government lacks integrity. And they really went for it. It was fairly breathtaking stuff, and the Prime Minister struggled with it. There was, very, very fierce questioning, quite the worst session for a Prime Minister in this kind of committee that I've ever seen, by some way. And during the course of it, the MPs are giving a running total of how many ministers have resigned. And in fact, while we're speaking, I'm seeing that, you know, there's talk that a delegation of cabinet ministers, including the ones newly promoted, have actually gone or are going to Downing Street right now to tell Boris Johnson that the time is up and the game is over. But there was one very interesting constitutional point that came up at the end of the two-hour session, which showed live on C-SPAN. And it was this. As you probably know, we don't have a written constitution, which is quite unusual. And that brings with it certain advantages and certain distinct disadvantages. And one of them is nobody's quite sure what would happen if a Prime Minister in these circumstances would think, well, I will have a general election. I will throw the dice and see what happens. And the question is this, would the Queen have to accept a request for a dissolution of Parliament and a new general election? Or could the monarch reject that and say, well, let's see first if anybody else could form a government with this parliament? And Boris Johnson was pushed on this again and again, right at the end of the session, by the chair of this committee, who is a Conservative. And by the way, the majority of the speakers in this whole session were Conservatives of Boris Johnson's own party. That they were the majority voice in this committee, and he was pushed again and again on this, and they didn't give a terribly clear answer, but the chair of the committee took it and understood it that he was ruling out a peremptory general election, an unnecessary general election, and that he would step aside. But that was... those were words sort of put into his mouth by the chair of the committee. It wasn't terribly clear what the Prime Minister was saying on that point.
We're talking with Peter Knowles, C-SPAN's producer in London. A final question about a procedure. Boris Johnson recently survived a vote of no confidence, and there was some reporting that he was immune for a time to another vote. How does this all work?
Yeah, it's quite a strange thing. The rules are set by a relatively informal group of Conservative MPs. It doesn't have any constitutional power. It just has power within the party. So if you think of the Prime Minister as a president, which he's not, then you'd think, well, hang on, this is like the president. The rules around the election being arranged by something that's not much more than like a golf club committee of management. They can change their rules. I mean, the rules currently are that if you survive a vote of confidence and it's done on a simple majority, then you can't be challenged again for 12 months. But this committee, it's called the 1922 Committee, this committee can set its own rules. So the mood in the party is such now that if Boris Johnson were not to stand down, then it wouldn't be too difficult for them to, on a majority vote of Conservative MPs, agree that the rules can be changed and that he can face another vote. And given how many ministerial resignations there have been last night and today, and I think we got to 32, but that was at the start of this interview, the maths are beginning to look really bad for Boris Johnson. And if there was a second vote, I think there's a very good chance that he would lose and would have to stand down as leader of the party. And then what happens if that were to happen? He could either stay on as Prime Minister until another leader is elected, or quit straight away and his deputy take over while the party sorts out the next leader. And this is like a primary process. It doesn't involve the wider electorate. They don't get a say. It's the because this is the party in power, whoever is their leader in Parliament is put forward to the Queen to be chosen as Prime Minister. So the process runs over of electing a successor, and we have seen this happen a couple of times because the Conservative Party has been quite ruthless about getting rid of its leaders in recent years. You get the successor in a matter of a few weeks.
Peter Knowles, C-SPAN's Westminster producer in London. Thank you very much.
Not at all. A pleasure.
And now a little bit of that two-hour session with the Prime Minister before the liaison committee as Conservative MP William Ragg asking about the viability of the government.
Good afternoon, Prime Minister.
Good afternoon.
I appreciate that today is a day of events, and though this meeting has not quite resembled a Moscow show trial, because I think certainly they were livelier, it must be nonetheless quite difficult, and I do pay tribute to you for turning up today.
I wouldn't dream of being anywhere else.
Indeed. Having said that,
delighted to be here.
Having said that, at which point does it become impossible for the Queen's government to be continued?
I really think that William, you're underestimating the talent, energy, and sheer ambition. Of members of Parliament, and they want to get things done. They want to get things done for their constituents, and the government of the country is being carried on with ever increasing energy.
Well, they seem to just want to get one thing done at the moment in time. I agree with you on that, but I think the issue that we have is that you've had at least my initial calculation at the start of the meeting was 27 ministers and aides resigning. There have been more in the meantime.
Member of Parliament, Conservative William Ragg, questioning British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, also Conservative. A bit of his appearance today before the liaison committee, comprised of parliamentary committee chairs in his party. You can find the full 2 hours at cspan.org, our video library, as well as today's Prime Minister's question time in the House of Commons. And thanks for listening to Washington Today. For more Washington stories sent to you every day, subscribe to C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.